Busy day, John?
Well, yeah, it has been actually. It's been a flurry of activity as I try to sort out what's going on here. How are you guys? Are we
Doing good.
recording now? Okay.
Yeah, it should be recording. Yeah, it looks like it's good.
Shall we do a little open frame? And then I would like to do maybe a clean start using a few clean language questions. And
I'll follow your lead, dancer.
we can co-lead, co-follow.
Yeah.
We evolve something of interest, I hope. Who wants to go first? Do we want to just do a round?
Well, before you logged on, we were talking about the book that Michael recommended in the first session about the marvelous, magnificent clouds, I believe.
Clouds
This one?
Marvelous. Yeah, clouds marvelous.
Yeah, I just got it. I just got it from the library.
Yeah,
I
The
read the
Marvelous
first.
Clouds by John Durham Peters. So
Yeah.
we're noting that Michael is rereading it. I'm on the second, or now third chapter. Made it past the ocean and into the fire, it sounds like. You
Did
said you've
you?
read a chapter, John?
I just read the intro, and it's very well written, and it covers a lot of topics that I'm very interested in.
Yeah, and me too. I was telling Douglas, I was quoting one of the lines from the introduction that's just relevant to the way I've been trying to express myself, is the body is the most basic of all media. And let's see, the body is the most basic of all media and the richest with meaning, but its meanings are not principally those of language or signs. Reaching instead, and I love this line, into the deep well stocked with vaguer limpid fluids. I love the, he kind of goes way out and then he's coming right inside the body, it feels like to me.
Vaguer liquid fluids, is that what he said? Limpid.
Limpic fluids, which, that I think that would resonate with kind of, our semantic and where we the nonverbals come from is from the limbic part of the brain, I believe.
Oh, limbic, yeah. He's a wonderful writer.
Yeah.
Good example.
Right. And so, it just I'm rereading it just to touch into it. I read it about 3 months ago and I put it away, but I know that it's been part of the way I've been trying to express myself too after reading him, and how much it resonates with me as far as working with trauma and resetting my own media network, kind of thing. So that's.
I can certainly resonate with that one. And about the body and about how you use your reading to you like a voice, you find someone who writes in a way that you like. I start to take it on, like put on a costume in a play, and then
Yeah,
I'll talk like that for a while. Then I'll take it off and I'll talk like another writer I'm reading. And I
right.
think that's a good way to read, actually.
Yeah.
Kind of using that theater metaphor.
Yeah, and this is just mine, turn the reading into a physicality, not just something in your head.
That's right.
I mean, words are like any, I think I like what he's saying. Words are, or I'm taking it this way, are like messages from the wind. I just have to kind of orientate, well, what direction is this author going with these words? Can I follow it? How much am I paying attention?
I love that. I like that quote. And maybe I could start off with something that I'm reading. This is I'm reading this book, Meeting the Universe Halfway.
Yeah,
And
I checked that out a little
I said I swore I would never read a book on physics again, and here I am. I hate physics,
bit.
I'm reading this and you know, she's really hitting the nail on the head, I think, as and I can't find this passage, this one passage, but she's talking also about the body and the boundary. And it's bringing up all kinds of issues that I believe are really fundamental to our capacity to function, really. It's this boundary between self and other, between inside and outside, between the world and the personal pronoun I. And I think these, and the intersubjective, the subjective, the objective, these are very much very fuzzy for us. And how much more fuzzy it gets when you start working with dreams.
Yeah, right.
Because her idea as a physicist is that we have instruments and we measure with those instruments. But where do those instruments come from?
Mm-hmm.
They come from us.
Right, right.
And we've already encoded in them. They are a practice for making divisions and cuts, and that we've already pre-designed. So how do you get away from theory to something that's, how do you get away from something subjective to something that's objective? It's not obvious.
No, it's not.
She says, try to measure a ruler, for instance, one of the simplest instruments you could come up with, right? Where does the ruler begin and end?
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's always an approximation,
right?
Inch or a quarter inch. So when you're talking about abstract truths that are objective, they're already mixed up and entangled with our imaginations, our creativity, our dysfunction, you know.
Sorry, John, would you, this is something I played, it's just acknowledging that abstractions are rooted in our sensory experience.
And we've
kind of forgotten that those abstractions began with our sensory experience. I think the difficulty in honoring sensory experience is it's so raw, you know, and this is another thing that I was reading another book that I referred to, you, that one of diverse bodies and diverse practices. I referred to you a while back.
Is that on the body worker? You mentioned the body worker.
Yeah, Nick Walker.
Well, when I had a chance to look him up. I'm going to, though.
I'm sorry. One of the things that kind of dovetails with this discussion in terms of the body, and because he's on the spectrum of autism, is whether you're autistic or non-autistic, we all find ways to regulate our sensory experience. And that regulation is conditioned by the environment we were in, you know, and who we were around. And of course, several of the people in that book are talking about how there's the non-autistic or people that aren't in their body demonize or, you know, condemn other bodies because they're different, like a fat body or, you know, an autistic body. He tells a story when he was in kindergarten they call it stimming. Have you ever heard of that, John? Stimming is actually using some sensory, like rubbing your finger on your, waving your hands or waving your hands to regulate your senses. Well, he was in kindergarten just with his finger going like this, and the teacher smacked him, and you know, he got abused versus people that he compared it. It was worse for him. It felt worse to him than people that kids actually hitting each other. Something about the teacher didn't like him stroking it, but he was trying to regulate his sensory input. And it kind of ties in with Aaron, of her work of autistics, and that's what he says, like Aaron says, is their brains are different in the sense that they don't have the parsing online like we do. You know, for some reason, they're slower to regulate their sensory input.
You're That I think is so interesting what you're saying. And I think maybe when I get more into the other book, that you just mentioned, The Marvelous Clouds.
Yeah, I think all the authors we're talking about really cover this particular.
Yes.
They work within a literary field, or like Aaron Manning is working philosophically with these ideas. Is it Karen Berard?
Yeah, Karen Berard.
But I did read part of that diffractions chapter, and she's essentially taking metaphor of diffraction against reflection as a mode of being in the world, or not even that, but as a way to describe her physics, to describe quantum physics. She doesn't jump into the physics. She starts with this metaphor sparked by Donna Haraway from her opening quote. And just I can't do it justice because I don't fully understand. The whole book sounds like it's about diffractions and difference rather than like the reflection mode of thinking.
I was wondering what you make of that diffraction metaphor, because now I'm trying it on, for putting that on and feeling my way around with that. And I find it a very interesting metaphor.
I think it will all tie together in some way if we do read these or put all these works together to create an environment of some sort that we can. It doesn't have to be. I know you mentioned the onto epistemological attitude and things like that, and all that is beyond my head. I said, I side with ontology because that's my grounding, and John always advocates for becoming the epistemological approach, and we're all trying to piece together different ideas, however you want to look at it, but to step away from just taking in that information and saying, we can maybe combine these two thoughts. Our approach is to go into it, to actually dive into it in dreaming, or as we walk about the world, we're not focused on our phones. We notice that the cloud textures are changing, and that's possibly a reflection of, or an influence from our mood or something, even just as a metaphor, that's enough to keep us going in this little space.
Can one of you give me a little detailed description of that metaphor, diffraction, so I don't assume.
I'll do my best, unless you want to go for it, Doug.
This was something I'm interested in, but.
Yeah, I'm starting to defect right at this moment. As I organize myself with this call, which I'm sort of why I like a clean start. And I guess this is my image du jour, is diffraction is kind of, we know that light is a wave, okay? And that if you just go to the beach and watch what's happening with the ocean, you'll see that waves interfere with other waves. They bounce off each other. They can cancel each other out, or they can flow between each other. They'll go within and beyond each other. And it's that kind of diffraction, those diffraction patterns that Karen Berard is likening to. Sort of, I think she wouldn't say this is an analogy. She would say that we're very entangled as these interference waves that cancel each other out, or go through each other, maintaining a shape while they go through each other. And that I think is of great interest, because she's looking at the differences in these diffraction, these patterns, the effects of these differences, and mapping them. So in a way, I would like to use this as my metaphor of the day in working with dreamscapes and those liminal zones, and how do we make the cut in our everyday social lives when we're booming and buzzing confusion all around us and we have our intentions and our purposes and desires. And out of that interplay, we make, this is the beginning of this, this is the end of that, this is a new beginning, and there's an ending, and here is something that I don't know if it, where it begins and where it ends. You know, so we're working with these kinds of dynamics, and that's our shared world out there, with the inside and the outside very fluid, and the subject and object are not neatly cut in a pre-given kind of Cartesian categories. And I think this is what she's pointing out to, that this, the diffraction patterns and wave, which a particle can't do this. A particle can only be at one place at one time. But a wave can, that's not a restriction for a wave. So using that metaphor, I start to sense into my own dreamscapes as diffraction patterns. And how do I, as the dreamer, as the agent, make a cut? And when a cut is made, then what follows is not arbitrary. So I believe these are the capacities we have through our consciousness. If we cultivate these capacities, we could create all kinds of different arrangements, living arrangements that work for us better. So that's what interests me. I hope that some of that made sense.
Yeah, it did. I have one quick question that I need to bounce off of you, John, because I've been thinking about it. Is a body a type of liminal space itself?
Yes. My guess is yes, it is. I don't think we know what the body is. And maybe that's what brings us together on some of these calls. And maybe we can assist one another in working with our dreams, because I feel like the body is, and I think you've mentioned this too, we could come up with many, many metaphors for the body. Many metaphors have emerged out of our history. And I believe we're only at the beginning of a new wave of new analogies and metaphors and ways of organizing as the agent becomes front and center in so many people's attention.
Yeah.
It's not obvious what the agent is doing. The agent is doing something.
Right.
And so, it's an active center. So that, I think, is the challenge for us as people, as artists, as interested citizens in figuring out what this agent is doing and thinking.
Right. And so I'm just popping right now, is that if I acknowledge that my own body is a liminal space, but it also has within it, because it's made up of matter, let's say, or coherent energy, it maintains a certain homeostasis for a time. And then when you add in your metaphor diffraction, that's when the homeostasis kind of enlarges or goes off, you know, which can be traumatic, or I like to say learning how to surf that. So, because I think the more that we allow the experience of the diffraction or the homeostasis being challenged, we actually create a larger basis for homeostasis.
I'm familiar with that concept, homeostasis, and as a something that you come back to, that helps the organism maintain a coherence. Like you know, our body temperature, if it goes up a few degrees or below a few degrees, we're in trouble, and the body works to maintain a steady temperature.
Yeah, so, this is from Anthea DiMaggio's latest book, Stranger Order of Things, and he focuses on especially the biological mechanism for that. He takes it to the extent of, we need to get we need to get real with this, because we're creating culture from that.
Yes, and Terence Deacon is adding something to that. He talks about homeo dynamics.
Uh-huh.
So that rather than homodynamic.
Okay.
So it's his idea, rather than homostasis, he talks about homodynamics.
Okay.
So I think that he's recognizing a lot of complexity theory and chaos theory, how something that I think Karen Barad is recognizing is that there's nothing fixed, but it's not arbitrary.
No.
There's much more fluidity, but it's not, we can't say it's all relative either. Just like the few temperatures in the body can create havoc, a few temperatures in our environment, half a degree, they say, could create enormous havoc in our environment. So this is cause of concern that I believe that we all are trying to use these theories to create some sort of match,
mm-hmm.
With our waking and our sleeping and our dreaming worlds.
Yeah.
So that for me, like becoming more coherent is not just a fun idea. It's like something we got to do pretty fast.
Right.
We had there a lot of environmental pressures.
Right.
Evolutionary pressures
to
make some sort of transition to another way of doing human.
Yeah. And thanks for your response, because I happen to be in where I live and the people I associate with. That's why I like coming here, because talking about a free form thinking like I do, I run into, I'm going to be slightly agitated, but I run into just contracted thinking and not just open-ended possibility thinking. Is the way I actually tell people, look, I'm a muscular thinker. I think with my body, all of it, not just one part of it. And my experience with people face to face is I can feel that makes them uncomfortable. So thank you guys.
Thank you. And Douglas, how did I do with that new metaphor? What were you picking up on?
Your metaphor there that I picked up on even more. But
the diffraction thing.
Diffraction.
Well, it's not a thing.
You explained it a little bit more than I could have and expanded my idea of it, and especially what you just said about bringing it into conversation, Michael, with everyday activity. There's a lot of this is all I can think of right here, and this is what we're going to talk about. And to be able to, she goes into the quantum physics, Karen Barad, and we have enough of those, like the fence metaphor we talked about instead of a wall.
Yeah.
She talks about the slit experiment and having the variation of where the slits are, then you can project yourself out into the unknown, and it makes beautiful patterns. These waves and I
can't find the quote, but she just uses the this is rather simple, easy to understand. If you're in a dark room and you have a cane, if you hold the cane lightly, it will be an object, a foreign body. But if you hold the cane firmly, that disappears. The cane is no longer a foreign body. And it becomes something that you can, it's an extension of your body, so that you can find your way around this dark room. So the boundary between that, the cane hasn't changed, it's still a cane, but it's your relationship to it can change dramatically from this to this. It's a foreign body. If you hold it like this, it's a part of your body. If you hold it like this, but that's not relative. Mm-hmm. It's not all just about my subjective experience. So I think that's what she's pointing out, that there's an interior objective, and I believe that is what's happening in dreamscapes. Can happen. Dreamscapes can just be about taking out the garbage, but if you bring intention into the dreamscape and say, hey, I want to learn about this or that, or I'm going to inquire about something, then that patterns can start emerging. and meta patterns can start emerging if you're there to translate. I think it's the dreamer as a metaphor for me is a translator, but then it can go into an even deeper level cycle as we start moving into lucid dreaming, which is I think a sort of meta level to something to out of body experience. But this is highly speculative at this point, a speculative pragmatics, I think, because I think it's becoming very important that we, as we break out of this Cartesian nightmare of thinking that the face in the mirror is who I am, to this more, which she's calling agential realism, that the agent makes the cut and co-creates, and that it is not just relative.
But it is relational.
That's right. That's right.
And that's interesting because Marshall McLuhan, I've always been fascinated in understanding media. There's a little piece where he says that he brings together the notion that touch is not skin. It, and I'm paraphrasing, it is where there is a ratio of all senses coming together.
Right.
And I just love that because for me, it gives a different dimension of how to relate to the tactileness of my own body. And objects in the environment, you know, that it's more of a relational than a relative way of moving in the world.
And that's a direction I would like to explore with you guys. I sort of want to do why I use clean language as a tool for investigating language and the patterns that we create linguistically is very connected to our somatic perceptual experience. And when we have a good dynamic flow between language and interior and exterior and objective and subjective, we find those liminal zones, those gaps in the in-between, where our agency becomes extremely important.
Right.
Rather than getting lost in the drama of the day, we get these little pop-up effects and say, "Oh, I wasn't aware of that." So it's sort of a something that we discover and something we create.
And I also like the added component, and I know you probably agree, the respect for the other and their use of language. That's one of the things that I gravitate is the respect for the other's use of language and being very careful that I'm not projecting my way of using language on another.
That's right. And that's why I, at this point in my life, this has become a very useful tool for investigating self and other dynamics and those boundary conditions.
Yes.
And also those, and the different ranges that the body can open up to.
Yeah.
So we have subtle bodies.
Right. And
subtle body is the wrong metaphor. I sort of think it sometimes tends to distort more than it reveals, because I believe for us, it's more, we're much more like a wave.
Yes. Right.
We're passing through other waves, and we're being interfered with by some waves, and we cancel each other out.
Right.
And where I begin and end is negotiable.
Exactly. And it also helps me, again, for myself, but also how I feel it from somebody else, of how we make the body an object.
Right.
So much of the time. And on a one certain level, that's operational. But we get stuck on that sort of operational level when, like you say, the next one is to see the body is more like a wave. It's porous, you know.
Right. Right. And it's good to have a mirror you can look in when you're shaving.
Yes. Right. Right.
So that's right. Good. But if we get stuck in mirrors and
the fun house of mirrors? The fun house?
Yes. So I think that mirror metaphor is it's ubiquitous and it's troublesome.
Yeah, there's a line from a country singer: "The mirror doesn't tell the whole story."
That's right. That's right.
I love it.
That's right. So I have a. So maybe we could do a little clean start if you guys are up for that, and I could do a little.
I'd love it.
But I was wondering, Dick, did you want to add anything? Did you want to jump in? Okay. Because I was wondering, I posted these from Michael Murphy's book.
Yeah.
For the body. I posted some a list of his attributes. And I don't know if you got a chance to read any of them, but a lot of these attributes and qualities seem to me to be very diffractive. Feeling that someone is watching you, after which you turn to meet his or her gaze. Synesthesias, the crossing of senses, seeing sounds, hearing flowers. Spontaneous, unexpected perceptions of distant events. I'm just picking out a few. Looking at something familiar and seeing it as if for the first time. In the apprehending the presence of someone physically distant or dead by direct and vivid contact. These seem to have a very diffractive kind of quality.
I agree.
Like waves, bumping into each other, canceling each other, or passing through each other.
Yeah.
Rather than the particle with I'm over here and that particle is over there. And we have this clear separation, spaces separating and dividing us. I think that's, you know, our tendency to be attracted to the particle is very challenged and threatened by this wave-like oscillations and turns and dips and pivots and topological figures. And I believe that's probably why our dreams are such a challenge for us to translate into particle language, which is what our language is. It's subject, object, verb, you know, it's arranged in a certain way. And you have to, whatever information or energy or whatever you want to communicate to another, and you're using language, you got to sort of work with that creatively. And I think poets go to the edge of that, and certainly dancers and singers and performers are doing something with language that's not like propositional truths, something else entirely. And certainly animals are doing something extra linguistic, which I believe he mentions that too, being able to pick up on the intention of an animal. But I think these are all kind of ordinary in a way. I would think anyone reading this list would say, yeah, I've had that experience.
And totally. I'm just amazed that, you know, I'm just grateful for us talking about it, because I think they're very ordinary. But when you engage people in the, you know, and I'm trying to give them some space, they probably haven't been given the safety to talk about it. Like I want to.
Like it's telepathic or paranormal or woo-woo stuff. But it's actually the everyday, you know, operational capacities. We're riding on waves. You know, our particle nature is totally dependent on this wave phenomenon.
Well, and that's why agency is important, because I think telepathic or not, how in touch or how, I don't know the right description of it, but how much you actually feel and own your agency will depend of the quality of, say, telepathy or sensation, you know, any of these other qualities. That's why it's good to sit down, shut up, and do some meditation, in my view.
Right. I use meditation that way as a way of just differentiating signal from noise.
Yeah.
Too noisy, there is no signal. And if it's, and sometimes the noise is the signal.
Yeah.
But you can't have a signal without noise. So I think that's part of that diffractive metaphor too.
Right.
That, and sound is a medium. And our auditory and our auditory digital and our kinesthetic and our visual are not in little buckets that are separate from one another.
Well, and the interesting thing about sound, John, and you probably know this, it can go through objects. Light gets, this is interesting to me, of just differentiating what these different sound, light, touch, or whatever. But it's interesting that sound can go through a lot easier than light can, depending on the density of the object.
Which is what I want, and I wanted to find this quote and read it, because it had to do with the visual system. And I think Oliver's about this. There are several researchers that Karen Barad was pointing out. She was saying they've done some studies on people who've been blind since birth, but the deformation in the eye was surgically corrected, and so that they could technically see after being blind from birth. But that wasn't necessarily the case. Some people registered no change at all, which created a flurry of consternation in those who performed the surgery, making this promise. And some researchers are beginning to understand that if you've never seen anything, if you haven't seen before, you wouldn't know what to look for. We're so visually obsessed, we visual people, that we can't imagine what it's like never after seeing anything before, and how what our seeing isn't just our eyeballs. It's our kinesthetic and our auditory, and being able to overlap in that diffractive way between all these different information that the different senses give us. Mm-hmm. And out of that comes our ability to see.
Okay.
And I find that another interesting way of thinking about the dreaming process as well.
Yes. Yeah. That would make sense.
So, Doug, what should we do next? Can we do a clean start? Or would that be okay with you guys?
For me, it's right. Yeah, I'm ready.
Because I feel like we've done an open frame and we could go in a lot of different directions. So maybe if I initiated this clean start, we could zoom in on something. And I will take notes.
Okay.
And another thing I would like to do, if we could go through that list, and if there's anything that pops out for you in that list, something that you're familiar with or something that you're attracted to, we could use some clean language to develop that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have one or two that I'm interested in.
Okay, good. Maybe we can, we'll focus on that after we do this clean start. So for this session, and we've been going 45 minutes, we could go another an hour, I'm sure, easily. For this session, Michael, to be really useful for you, this session will be like what?
It will be like walking into the ocean and going only so far from the shore, but I won't be able to touch the bottom.
Walking into the ocean and you won't be able to touch bottom, but not too far from the shore.
But not too far from the shore.
And for you to be walking into the ocean, not too far from shore, won't be able to touch the bottom, you will be like what?
A jellyfish.
Jellyfish. And what support do you need from me and Doug so that this could happen?
I it's on the tip of my brain. I can't image it. To be like water.
Be like water. I'm sure Doug and I can translate into something, into something. Douglas, would you like to go next? For this session to be really useful for you, this session will be like what? Oh, wait a minute. That's great. This session will be like what?
Well, continuing with her metaphor, I feel the direction the conversation has taken already. And your phrase, maybe something will come out of this, kind of hone in on a certain perspective. I think for it to be useful for me, it will naturally happen. I don't want things forced.
It will naturally happen, honing in on a perspective.
That's right.
And when honing in on a perspective and naturally happy, for this session to be like that, you will be like what?
I'll be riding along on the waves with Michael as well, but I think on the surface.
Riding along with Michael on that surface. And what support do you need from Michael and myself?
So I've got a surfboard, so that's supporting my body. And then wherever you are, John, I'll be looking out for you. And I know Michael's underwater. Kind of just moseying along like a jellyfish, it sounds like.
For this session to be really useful for me, this session will be like coherent patterns, diffractive patterns. That makes any sense, but and for this session to be like that, well, actually, it could be a walk on the beach, actually. It would be like walking on the beach and hearing the tide coming in and coming out and hearing the voices of people, you know, listening to the radio along the beach. And it would be the smell of the salt air. So it would have that relaxation that the body has with all these multiple rhythms, inside and outside sort of blurs. And I've had that face down in the ocean and floating on top of it with the eyes closed and holding the breath and just floating. And that wonderful feeling of letting go. And you can do it on your back as well and looking up at the sky, and you feel this merger between sky and the ocean and the body. And I believe that all of that can get amplified in our dream states or in our conversations as well. I think we can do this with language games, as we're doing right now. I mean, we're using language a certain way. So that's the support I need too, is just the listening space that they're co-creating here, so that these non-ordinary kind of perceptions can come forward, sort of chunking down and chunking slow, my motto here. So do you got a chance to look at the list too, Doug?
Is there in front of me right now? Yes.
Is there one of those that pop out at you or attract you or repel you or something there that you've had experience?
So you mentioned having an out of body experience after reading these. Before two. I read that, yeah, two.
I had two in one night. I had two out of body. That's very odd for me.
So I'm basing my experience coming into pretty much any of the activity with intellectual work outside of my brain, dream work, conversational work as well. I'm the newbie. I'm still my experience level is pretty low, but it's just enough to understand certain things. So before I read this list, I do my 30-minute dark meditation I might have mentioned, where I turn out all the lights and I can have my eyes open or closed. And that's a good, I'm interested in the sensory deprivation. So vision, you mentioned a little bit ago, as being that force in our life that we can't imagine other human beings, even that are blind, as not having visual cues to the even single point or any object that would be just such a challenge. And for us to perceive that, it's such a challenge. But in order to reach that state, we need some sort of deprivation, whether it's, so I was there essentially doing yoga nidra type techniques to get into a relaxed state. My current focus, I've been having memories of dreams, but not progressing towards lucid dreaming, I think, in dreaming. So I'm resorting to what is called the WILD method, waking induced lucid dreaming. So you essentially get your body into a meditative state. And from there you attempt to shift the visuals you're having into the hypnagogic imagery, into some sort of dreamlike state, hopefully a lucid dreamlike state. But so I still have, I think I've glimpsed maybe 5 seconds of an actual lucid dream to where I can say, okay, this is what I'm looking for. So I have that small amount of experience. But just yesterday I reached an out-of-body experience, and it was in the way I'm going to describe it. Of course, words will not do it justice, but I essentially had sleep paralysis. I relaxed to that point to where I couldn't tell if my right arm was my left arm, or if they were, my arms were crossed or to my side. I didn't quite know. But it was in slow motion to the point that it wasn't me rising out of my body so quickly, but it was almost like a pulsation, a vibration, and or even like a movie reel, the old movie reel, kind of going slow, you hear the clicking. So it was almost as if I was experiencing some sort of movie of myself slowly coming out, and I did a quick little degree change, shifting, and then back into my body, as if this was maybe a 5 to 10 minute experience. But it's very interesting what the body can do, or the body can't do, and the imagery that forms in total darkness. I would consider that a dreamlike state that I was in. It was a whitish, grayish light, kind of like pulsating sketch of darkened light shifting. So
a grayish, whitish light and pulsing. And OBE, sleep paralysis, couldn't tell left from right, slow motion, a movie reel going slow, and then a degree change, and then a return. And the WILD method, meditative state, shifting the visuals, in 5 seconds, perhaps, of a lucid dream, and yoga nidra, a relaxed state in the dark. And with all of that, what would you like to have happen now?
The relay of the information into the communal sphere, as what just occurred right now is. So I've been imagining somebody like you, John, who your writing is fiction, not necessarily, you're not explaining things in writing, so to speak, but how do we as a group, or you, since you're such an avid reader, how do you project that into the world and outside of like the internal, in a way that other people can understand, in a way that's not just a waste of it might be great for you to read this material, but it would be a waste if it could not be shared. So I've gotten a lot.
And relax. And a relay of information into the communal sphere. And that question, how do we project that out into the world in a way that others can understand? And a communal sphere. And when a relay of information into the communal sphere, is there anything else about, communal sphere? Does that communal sphere have a size or a shape?
It does.
Sorry, Tony, it has a shape. I'm sorry. It's a little redundant.
But the size, that was, before you finished there, I was thinking of, I want this mentality, this being, this forming of information that the three of us are doing here, to be a part of, as Michael talked about, daily conversations with others that are willing to receive. I would like for the range to be also age range, include our elders, include our children in these conversations, and not just keep it tidy here on some website that's tucked away that only a few like-minded souls might see. So the space has a grand size, though it should and can include, and I'm talking about humans here, and since we're focusing on the animal world, it can include quite a bit more.
And humans and animals, and for this foray of information into the daily world, and there's an age range of elders and children, and this space has a grand size. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say grand size?
I used that word.
I'm not sure. I may have misheard you. I just want to be. Did you hear that, Michael? Did he say grand size?
I thought he did.
Yeah. Grand size, and humans and animals. And then what happens? Or can that happen?
Yes, yes, it can.
And it has. And when it can and it has, is there anything else about that? When it can and has?
And it will, I guess. So it will keep occurring. And the layers, hopefully, explain a bit more to us as we go along.
In the layers?
To the point that we can be aware of all the different layers in order to include.
And we can be aware of all the different layers. And when we can be aware of all the different layers, is there anything else about aware? Whereabouts is that aware when we can be aware? Does that aware have a size or a shape?
I guess it gets mixed up in the quantum weirdness. somewhere in there.
Mixed up in the quantum weirdness. When mixed up in the quantum weirdness, what happens to different layers?
So right now the words that I want to say are coming directly from the diffraction page, but she says it is possible to work backwards from a diffraction pattern to deduce features of the diffraction grating, whatever that means. And in this way, determine the structure of the substance in question. I just had it highlighted from my reading, but I don't know the context really.
Can you repeat that?
It seems to be describing the layers you're talking about.
Ah, okay. And it's
page 84 from the diffractions chapter.
From diffraction backwards, working from the diffraction backwards. Could you repeat that?
So she's actually talking about the wavelength of X-rays. And since it's known in advance, it is possible to work backward from the diffraction pattern to deduce features of the diffraction grating, such as the distance between slits of molecules and atoms. And in this way, determine the structure of the substance in question. So it's losing its meaning as I read it. But
and when it's losing its meaning as you read it.
And went too technical.
And went too technical. And we can be aware of all the different layers. And when it goes too technical, and we can be aware of all the different layers, is there a relationship between we can be aware of all the different layers and going too technical and losing the meaning?
It's when it's time to pass the baton. To be honest, if we reach that point, then that's when the community comes into play, the interaction of the particles upon and waves upon each other.
Thank you. It feels like a natural pause has occurred. And if it feels right to you to draw, make a representation of this in a way that makes sense to you, and then I can ask Michael some clean questions. If you found something in that list on the future of the body that you gravitate towards or...
The main one is synesthesia. And then I'm not, because I'm going on memory, but I'm going to, maybe there's some on there that will match what I'm thinking of de-densifying and de-centering.
De-intensifying and de-centering?
De-densify, density, making less dense, and de-centering are the three that, since it's Asia, I know was on that list. I don't know about that, what I just described.
And synesthesia and de-densifying and decentering.
Right.
And when synesthesia, de-densifying, decentering, what are you most drawn to?
I'm drawn to the openness, expansion of the density and centering of the boundaries around me and within me.
And the opening and the expansion and the decentering of boundaries within you.
Yeah, and the density too. The density probably would probably be the one of the main. But by getting less dense, it feels like there's a sense of Asia as there's a crossover of the feeling and the sight of spaciousness, or feeling of spaciousness, you know, because some the mental constructs of dividing the senses becomes less dense.
And less dense, and a crossover, mm-hmm. and spaciousness.
Right, expansion too.
Spaciousness and expansion. And when decentering and a crossover and spaciousness and expansion, then what happens?
then there's a jellyfish feeling of being just enough dense to float in something that's larger than I was thinking of myself as.
And a jellyfish feeling. And whereabouts is that jellyfish feeling?
Right around my heart.
And that jellyfish feeling right around your heart, is there anything else about that feeling right around your heart?
Again, this is probably where synesthesia comes in, because then there's colored many shades of blue and some green. Probably, probably because of reflecting the ocean, color of the ocean, the colors in the water, and the light on the top of the water.
And a light on top of the water?
Yeah, coming through the water. Light coming through the water.
Light coming through the water.
Yeah.
And the color, shades of blue and green. And then what happens to that space, or to that heart, that feeling around the heart?
There's a incremental slowing of the beat, the pulse. It doesn't stop, but it slows way down, that at times it has scared me.
And then in a slowing of the heartbeat incrementally till it almost stops. And scaring.
At times.
At times. And at times when it scares you, what happens right before scares you?
There's a feeling of being lost.
And a feeling of being lost. And when a feeling of being lost, what would you like to have happen?
To be held.
To be held. And is there anything about to be held?
It's primal.
It's primal. And when it's primal, wanting to be held, what happens right before primal?
Darkness.
And darkness. And where does that darkness come from?
I don't know.
And I don't know. And when I don't know, is there anything else about that I, when I don't know?
It's real.
It's real. And then it's real. What happens to afraid or fear or scare when it's real? What happens to scare?
It diffuses into peace without understanding.
And it diffuses into peace without understanding. And when it diffuses into peace without understanding, what happens to synesthesia?
It seems to have done its task.
It's done its task. And is that a good time to pause?
Thank you. Yes, it is.
And could you represent that in a way that makes sense to you?
Yes, I will.
Okay, thank you. And hey, Doug, are you still there? Doug,
but I'll let you. Yeah,
there he is.
Sorry, if I receive a phone call, then since this is on my phone, I get kicked off for a minute.
Is everything okay?
Just block the call, and here I am.
could we look at your representation?
So I don't know what quite to make of it yet, but it turned into almost like a strange monkey face, but that's not really what's going on. So it started with a drawing of like a body lying down in the darkness. The darkness was drawn later, but there's some sort of field forming with multiple lines in the outer shell that I imagined as an ocean wave. And so I'm lying there as the wave, the crest of the wave crashes, but I'm in the midst of it, so there's a sort of quiet serenity, I suppose, in between there. So there's a lot of the reflections of what Michael was talking about, too, and it turned into an ocean metaphor. These were the communal fields that formed, and I forgot what they originally were. I don't know. They're layers of something. So that's about it.
And there's a body lying down in quiet serenity, and the ocean wave, and the communal fields, and layers. And what are you most drawn to?
That those circles in the middle, the kind of building layers, it almost looks like a light space within the dark, or clouds forming in the middle of that wave crashing. I don't know exactly what it is. I'd like to find out.
And you don't know exactly what it is, but you would like to find out. And when you don't know exactly what it is, but you would like to find out. That's find out like what?
So it is a light spot, so it could be a blank state, and or a cloud of unknowing.
Uh-huh. A light spot, a cloud of unknowing. Is there anything else?
No.
Thank you. And Michael, when you're ready, just let us know.
Yeah, give me a few minutes, probably less than two.
So we can go into a light trance or a deep trance, if we want to, Doug? While Michael's finishing that up.
Okay. I'm ready.
Great.
Can you show your...
Can you see this?
Yeah, a little closer, a little higher and a little closer. Okay. I see it. That's good.
Jellyfish in the center. There's gold light, gold symbolizing light coming down through the ocean. The jellyfish is floating in the ocean. There's some, just for coloration, because from what I've seen of jellyfish, they're white. But so for purposes, I made some colors like a flesh outline around the body and the tentacles that reach down. And there's a just ball or diffuse form of energy as the life force, and there's tried to put a little bit of seaweed in here floating around, and tried to paint draw a color in the color of the water of green and blue, but I didn't have blue, so I used purple. And it's the tentacles are reaching down and it's floating, you might say, about 3 feet just below the surface, and tried to make a feeling that it is affected by the hidden unseen currents of the water, but it seems to be stable. It's not bothered by it, and the currents aren't intense, because if it was intense, that you would, the jellyfish would be just all over the place.
And the hidden currents, unseen.
Unseen, yeah.
And not intense.
Yeah.
And seems stable. And the tentacles that reach down and
down.
Float. And a diffuse energy, a life force, and seaweed. The color of water and purple and green, I believe you said.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You didn't have blue.
Yeah, I didn't have blue. My group of pencils didn't have blue.
And with all of that, what happens? What are you most drawn to?
The movement, the relationship between movement and the organism of the jellyfish.
And the movement and the organization.
The organism of the jellyfish as organism, living, you know, experiencing movement.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do you have those clean languages, those developing questions in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Could you be so kind as to just ask me, and Douglas, do you have them in front of you? If you don't mind this, doing this exercise. You're muted, Doug, just listen.
So I have them somewhere. I can access them here in just a second. But if Michael's got it, go on ahead there.
Yeah, I got them.
And we could practice if you would like.
Yeah.
I will. You develop something here out of this list. I tell you the one I was most drawn to. If I can find it. It's about, a lot of these experiences are familiar, but I can't find it here, but I'll just paraphrase it. It's understanding something complex. Okay. All at once.
All at once? Yeah. And when you're
Yeah, that's good. Go.
And when you're understanding something complex, is there anything else about it?
Well, I feel a lot of movement and energy inside my head and maybe about a foot beyond my cranium. There seems to be a kind of buzzing activity between my nervous system and something else. I don't know what that something else is.
And when your nervous system and that something else, what kind of what is going on?
There's a, I want to say discourse, but that's not quite it because I'm not familiar of any kind of, there's no one telling me to do anything in any particular way or to say anything in any particular way, but it's right at the borderline between that formless and words. And the words come out in a kind of, not always particularly articulate, but the understanding is there. And, or in here, there and in here. It's in the nervous system, but it's also beyond the nervous system. And it's something that happens. And it leads to the voice box and a desire to read, a desire to write or speak about this exchange. But it's happening up here. I can feel it.
Okay. And when it's happening up there and you want to speak, does it have a size or shape?
It has well, there is something happening. It's sort of way back there. So it's sort of an omnidirectional, but I feel something behind me that goes way, 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 way back there. And it kind of has a tunnel-like, but almost an oblong, sort of an oblong shape. Kind of blobby, actually, and dark. But what's in my cranium and outside of my cranium, this is very warm and buzzing and vibratory. As a kind, it jiggles, sort of like jelly. I guess that's sort of like my brain. It's this kind of jello, kind of gush, but there's something that sort of, some sort of current that flows through it, and it turns into a kind of recognizable structures that allow me to articulate what's happening. But it's usually not happening out in any kind of, as I'm doing now, doing this sort of micro level perceptual investigation. I'm using the words that I'm using now are very sort of unusual for me, because in my usual kind of discourse events, I'm not doing this. It's just a but just to flow. And I'm usually directing it towards others who are in a flow state with me, and there's enough security already there so that unusual and novel experiences can be absorbed by the group. I tend not to say this stuff out loud around people that I don't feel are trustworthy or who don't have a strong sense of themselves or others. And it can easily get disturbed by interference, those interference patterns. So I like to use writing as well as speech. The interplay of speech and writing becomes an interesting way of contrasting and comparing these, I guess you would call them altered states of consciousness, which are dreams and out-of-body experiences and everyday interactions with others can be all equally fascinating and troubling. So being able to adequately translate it's not obvious how to do this.
Wow.
I don't want, just any key words you found in that. I mean,
thank you. And I got caught up in your description. when you're working with, did you say the tension of translating, or
I could have, it could be tension, or I may have said a tension. I'm not sure.
Is there anything else about that feeling of translating? And what is there anything else about translating?
Yeah. Well, it's bizarre. It's sometimes there are no reference points. It's definitely not something. There's a point and there's a wave. And the point cannot do what the wave can do. But in a way, the wave can't do what the point can do. There's an interchangeability, I believe. And where the cut between self and other, how that cut is made has a lot to do, I believe, with the communal. It's an energy, it's a vibration, it's a quality, it's very ephemeral. And this kind of, this particle sort of mindset where I'm over here, you're over there, and I know where the grid is. And I know how all this works. So I think there's this juxtaposition of this wave and these diffraction, these diffraction patterns and the language game that I'm employing when I'm with others who are in the particle. I'm a particle, you're a particle, we're particles. And what happens when we're trying to translate into particle, our particle nature, something that is wave oriented, or happened in a wave state.
Does particle have a shape or size?
Yeah, it's dense. It's rock hard. It's sort of black. I feel like it's like a little, it's like a cube. Mm. Points, sharp points. Mm. It's kind of small. And I feel like it's located right behind my speech box. In the back of my, I'm pointing right here, my neck. So it's right back there. It's sort of right behind the vocal apparatus, and it emanates a little bit beyond it, beyond the surface of my, beyond my body.
Hmm. And when that particle, what kind? I mean, kind. What?
Right. Well, it is like a cube, and it is pointed, and it does rotate, and it does rotate, and it goes this way, and it can go that way, and it sort of, and it sort of picks up on. Different, I want to say lines of thought, but it's also, it's much more of, I'm going to let my body do the talking here. It's a very, it's like that.
Okay, when like that, and I'm going to, for purposes of me trying to exercise this, is there a weight? What weight is it?
Weight, okay. It's very light. I would say it's almost like weightless, sort of diaphanous. Doesn't have a texture, really. It's not a thing. It does have the size. It does have a size or shape and qualities, but it isn't what I would call. It doesn't have the thing like. It's not something I could ever hold in my hand. It's not like that at all. You can pause anytime you want to because I know this is complex.
Yeah. I'm going to pause because I think I've reached the edge of trying to practice.
You did great. That was very helpful. I really learned a lot. And maybe is there any questions you wanted to ask me before we do a wrap up? Feel free to join in.
Well, that was good to listen to there, Michael. You're a natural.
Just not used to it, I guess.
So we've been, it's a 1:31. So we can go a little longer if you guys like. We can do,
I'm fine.
Appropriate? Is this a natural flow for you guys? If we do a little, what did we learn today kind of thing?
Yeah. I'm a jellyfish. I'm rolling.
Okay.
it's coming in a wave-like structure from the crescendo and back to the beginning of kind of piecing it together.
Well, I learned that, Michael is really good at using clean language with a very complex landscape like mine. So I really appreciate your just going for it that way. And I realized this thing, I have a mild form of Tourette's. And it was made much worse by working with a psychotherapist.
Oh, wow.
He was doing very traditional uncovering of trauma, which is not recommended.
Yeah.
Don't need to relive trauma.
No.
To release it. Actually, reliving trauma does the opposite of releasing it. It tends to embed it much more deeply in the nervous system. So she kept doing all these, which produced almost something like a breakdown. And the symptoms got, actually, I didn't have any symptoms. I was free of all of this until I started doing work with her.
Oh,
she didn't know how to work with PTSD. She didn't know how to do that. And she actually started, she created Tourette's and Tourette's-like symptoms. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what to do with it. And I went to, fortunately, I heard about clean language. I read the book by Penny Tompkins and James Lawley, and I loved it. And they were doing a workshop not too far away, so I went and did it. And then I ended up becoming their assistant for a subsequent wave of workshops that they did up at the Omega Institute. And then I went to London, and then I went to France, and I studied with the organizations that they had started. They had a lot of practitioners, and I I worked with a lot of different practitioners, and this corrected that. The Tourette's, the symptoms, which I was able to, there are various kinds of Tourette's. Some people can control them. Some people can't, and that's the most dramatic reports. We see people who, you know, say anything that pops up in their mind, they can't stop. They'll say it out loud, and it'll be accompanied by all kinds of jerking motions. And it will distress other people quite a bit. I didn't have that form. Mine was much more subtle and controllable. But I processed it in private. And that's when the yelling and the screaming and the weird kinds of gesturing would start happening. Fortunately, I lived alone. So others were not subjected to it. But whenever it happened on the street or anything like that, I noticed very quickly people looked at me like I was insane and moved away. We were on a platform on the train. They moved away. So I learned, oh, okay, I need to control this.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to hold down when I feel this coming up. So I felt this elimination of these symptoms was great. And working with someone that I trained who did clean language, I worked with him for about a year. Maybe I can bring him on here to one of our meetings someday, because he's a really nice guy. And he's very adept at using these techniques. But we together explored a lot of interior spaces together. And that's why I think this is such a wonderful tool, as you just demonstrated, Michael. I felt you really helped me hone in, and you did not interfere.
Yeah, I was trying to maintain, I was trying to, if you don't mind me just expressing it, I was trying to use these questions as guidelines, but that's why I felt like I had to adjust it, because what I wanted to hear from you, and I know part of it, I'll just own it, part of it is when you went this way with your neck, I have a certain neck injury, and I just wanted to feel into, well, does it have a weight?
And when you wanted to into,
yeah,
and you were aware that that was you wanting to feel into, and that was your question about weight, and I could respond to that, and that's a perfectly good question. It's not a clean question, but and you know that,
right.
I think that you know that difference between this is something you want to know about this person's process.
Yes, right.
It's subtly different.
It is. It's very different.
This is their process.
Yeah, right.
These questions are actually designed to protect them.
Right.
From my curiosity about them.
Yeah, right.
In the traditional conventional kind of way. You can still be curious, intensely curious. But that I think is a really good, you're very aware of your model of the world and the other person's model.
Right.
And you were curious, and you asked a question. And I'm just saying that's fine.
But it wasn't a clean question, and that's why I was nervous about asking it.
And that's great. I mean, I think it just shows that you're very sophisticated about your communication strategy, and you know what's yours, and you know what someone else's. And I think our traditional conversational modes really support that kind of answer, question, response.
Right.
And I did say that it didn't have a weight. It did seem weightless.
Yeah.
And it also didn't seem, and it seemed autonomous, in a sense, like something that my body was doing, that I didn't have, I could stop it, but I couldn't replicate it. Like right now, I'm doing this. But what that was doing was not me. It was something.
Right.
But it wasn't, it was intelligent and knew what it was doing because someone had asked.
Right.
And these are hard things to do. Like these clean language questions are, you can do them on yourself. But I also find it's hard to track your response when you're doing it on yourself. Whereas if another person, I can track their response. I can write it down and do the best I can to find the key words and by playing back the key words that they actually used, they can start to organize their, they can find the structure.
Well, and that's why it seems to be a critical component is listening, the quality of listening. And one of the things I noticed in asking the questions is being aware of my listening, because I'm very aware that listening is a skill that I can't push away my curiosity. I just don't get involved in it.
I appreciate that. I mean, I think you're doing clean language. Everyone is going to be different the way they use it. And for me, it's kind of a ritual. And
yeah.
For my ego fixation on how a conversation is supposed to go, because I have no idea what they're going to say in response to this clean question.
Yeah.
And whatever they say, I go with it.
Yeah.
Which I would not necessarily do in a traditional conversation.
So I have a question.
I correct it. I might have a disagreement or an agreement, but it would be a different space.
Then I have a question. And you're listening. Is there something that pulls your attention to fill in the question?
Oh, that's a good question, because there is a structure to how the questions are sequenced.
Yeah.
That's a little more elaborate than what I was asking you to do, too, was to restrict yourself to those developmental questions.
Yeah.
What quality, the size and shape.
Yeah.
And those are only three out of a half dozen questions that you can ultimately use. But I think it's important to start with those developing questions, because I find 80% of the questions I ask are developmental questions. Does it have a size or shape? Whereabouts is that?
Okay.
And looking at the qualities and locating it in the perceptual space. Then you can ask about relationships. Is there a relationship between this and that, or here or there? And does that have a size or a shape? And what are its qualities? And then it gets complex.
Yeah, you're
working with location, and you're working with meaning and relationships.
It seems like we're working with a very dynamic form of agency of where I'm going to decide where my attention needs to go to ask you the question.
That's right. Absolutely. There is a very heightened sense of agency. And what you just said, I think I would say I'm paying attention to what you're paying attention to.
Okay.
When I can pay attention to what you're paying attention to, I can get you to pay attention to what you're paying attention to.
No, I like the way you say that, because I think that's why the type of listening you need is listening by paying attention to what the other person is paying attention to.
Sure. That creates a shared attention.
Yeah.
Because we're both paying attention to the same.
That does,
I think, enhance agency in both persons.
Yeah. I noticed that I feel that part of the way I was working, I was more concerned about just filling in the question than there was a little bit of not listening well, so I could fill it in.
I think your attention becomes multifaceted in a way, because you have to pay attention to many different things at the same time.
Yes, yes.
And then hone in. And clean language is a great way of forcing you to pay attention. Because
exactly.
I can't ask anything I want. I can only ask these few questions.
Exactly. So, no, that's right.
Then I have to listen very carefully to what the person actually says.
Exactly. That's exactly, yeah. I get it, yeah.
That's the pleasure of it. And I think it does enhance, I believe, a sense of agency in both persons. And I find it releases me from the traditional therapeutic transference counter.
I love that. I love that.
That stuff is such a waste of time, you know. And I did it for years.
Yeah.
Paid tons of money to people who just abused me, basically, with their theory of the world.
Well, I hate running into it on the street, because so much of on the street, people have been psychologized through Dr. Phil and different things. Oh, you're projecting.
Right.
Okay, damn. Right. Jesus, we're into conversation.
Exactly. And this is a way of, I think, creates a ritual so that we can observe and claim our projections. And we don't have to act. We can still have them, but we don't, because we're constrained by the language.
Right.
Questions we can ask. We can say, oh, that's my stuff.
Yeah.
So I can claim it. I don't have to ignore it, but I don't have to act on it.
Yeah.
So I then protect this relationship from contaminating it with my pre-given theories.
Exactly. It's sort
of bypassing what they call in philosophy the myth of the given.
Yeah.
And, we think we're saying something original, but actually, we've learned it from somebody else who learned it from somebody else who learned it from somebody else. And we don't know where it comes from, but we're acting as if it's the law.
Yeah, and exactly.
And impose it on somebody else. And if you ask them where it comes from, they don't know where it comes from. It's the myth of the given, you know? And I think that's something that we could get a lot better at. Stop to these myths that we know that don't belong to us really anymore.
Well, I feel Kling language resonates with me like a Zen koan.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of ritual focus. Okay, I have a paradox in front of me. You're the paradox, you know.
That's a beautiful metaphor. I like that one.
You know,
then go on. That's great. And this does actually enhance my curiosity enormously about the others, the other and boundary and the nature of those boundaries.
Yeah.
And how fascinating another person quickly becomes when I drop all my theories about who they are.
Oh, it's beautiful. You can feel it when you give people space. And I resonate really well because a lot of my speech was corrected because I had a speech impediment. So that's probably why I don't want to do it to other people. I want to try to listen to their speech, their language, and a way and a different way than I was treated when I was growing up. But sometimes you just have to say fuck.
That's right. Douglas, did you learn anything today that's useful or delightful that you would like to share?
Just a few tidbits of conversation. Right now I feel like I'm the listener listening to the listener helping the listener to listen. And there's just not necessarily going back to the listening only, but Michael said it a while ago near the beginning of the conversation that to have like-minded listeners can really bridge the gap to these alternate states and realities that I think we're all dying to experience, get out of that mundane state.
Yeah, and I think, and dying is probably a very useful word.
Yeah.
Because there is an element of dying involved. I mean, we have to die so that this, whatever this stuff is, new stuff can start to live. And I think what part wants to live and what part wants to die is negotiated every day. I know large chunks of my memory. I've started to vacate. I've disentangled from, and I think it's floating. It's floating and it's going way back there. It doesn't disappear entirely, and I can use it if I want to. But a lot of it just doesn't seem to apply and could be a lot of just toxic junk that has no use at all.
Yeah, and get in the way.
It sure can get in the way. So that's what I'm learning about. And I'm learning about that particle and that pointy little cube that's in the back of my throat and how it rotates and it picks up on a wide range of affects and sensation and information that somehow gets decoded. But it's not my ego that does that decoding, that's for sure. This sounds very Aurobindo to me, doesn't it to you, Doug?
It all links back to what we're reading there too. And I'm trying to keep it out because I know it can get pretty lofty, the ideas that are presented there. But it's all the scaling effect, and you can easily get lost in the nether regions, but you can also do what you're doing and dispose of those memories of whatever and kind of watch them, give them a wave as they take a voyage out to sea, and they might come back when you need them, or doesn't necessarily have to be a phone call away. These are memories that we can shed, so we can open up path and a journey towards various other realities.
So it's something more fulfilling.
Yeah, right.
Like carrying around a dead baby, hoping it'll come alive. You just need to bury the baby and bless it, you know, and move on. I think this is the Buddha story.
Yeah, it is. It's the Buddha story, yeah.
He tells that to a grieving mother.
Yeah, to go find a family that hasn't experienced death.
Exactly.
I think. One of the things I find as a concept idea is the interdependency of these ideas. I mean, actually, Aurobindo, the way I'm hearing about it, and I wouldn't doubt that Alan Watts read Aurobindo, his association with Murphy. And so it's just interesting to me. I have these memories of running across this idea way back then, and it's been percolating in my, you know, in my compost pile way back then. And now I engage in conversations with you two and other people, and it's like, oh, now the seed is beginning to have some growth of how to actually take ideas as very real things that I can work with and road test, per se. You know, I'm gonna go Chuck Yeager on these ideas and see how well they stand up.
There's another metaphor, ideas as real things and road test.
Yeah. I've given myself permission in the last few years to actually honor the fact, because of my reading, more by myself, of, and it goes to your point, John, of owning our metaphorical function in our brain, and it can harm us if we're not related to it. It can definitely harm us. You know, I have a few friends that I actually use clean language, kind of, but I'd probably tweak it in my sense. You know, but I'm going, do you really believe that metaphor?
Yeah, I had this, hold on just a sec. If I can find, oh dear, I don't want this stack of books to collapse on me. Well, this is sort of not an obvious thing, but here's a map. Can you see this?
Yeah, somewhat, yeah.
Maybe. Okay. Let me see if I can get more light.
Okay.
Is this?
Yeah, up a little, yeah, right there, okay.
It says outer being, inner being,
innermost
being, and there's these concentric circles.
Yeah.
This is a model, a very simple one, the concentric system, it's called, on the structure and organization of the being. But since Doug is working with this as well as myself, working with Aurobindo, and you just mentioned Aurobindo, Michael, and his relationship with Murphy.
Yeah.
And working with the future of the body as we just did. And we're reading this new book by John Peters, and I think we've been quoting also from Karen Barad today. So we're looking at all these different models.
Yeah.
And what we just did with our drawings, these are representations, these are models, mm-hmm. these are gestures. and their communications.
Right.
And I believe that it's the juxtaposition of these gesture communications, mm-hmm. and our language and the field.
Right.
And I believe that we're coming up with new models, and we're also, as we've been having this discussion today, we're looking at how we model. We're looking at meta-modeling,
right?
And the sort of the subtleties, and how, because we're modeling ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe working with another person, but we're also modeling ourselves. We're paying attention to what we're paying attention to,
right?
And paying attention to what that person is paying attention to,
right?
And I believe this is the essence of good models emerge out of this kind of interplay, just like diffracting waves
mm-hmm.
that interfere, cancel, or pass through one another. Right. So I believe our juxtaposition of models and metaphors and theories and is extremely crucial that we get better at this.
Yeah.
I'm not so tired of sitting in groups of people and they're just talking mush.
Yeah.
Very educated mush. They have PhDs and it's mush, mush, mush.
Right.
It's all concepts disconnected from the perceptual system, and they think they're geniuses or something. And I get very frustrated as a very perceptual learner.
Right.
Like, how can I road test this, you know?
Yeah. Well, like Peter's in that book, you know, it was even in the introduction, he's trying to make a point that, you know, media was originally had to do with the elements.
Right.
The water was a meter, you know, and these are, and he's trying to break. Yeah. And he's trying to make a point too, is that, and it goes to your point. Yeah. We have these concepts, but you know, we also have these nonverbal, these below the conceptual. And I've come to understand of, and you've even said it in other things of, we have to have a dual attention.
Right.
And sometimes, yeah, we have to focus on, say, how we conceptualize. We need to pay attention to that. But if so many people are emphasizing that and not, okay, how do I feel my, you know, feeling my body's perception of what's going on? And it goes to my metaphor with the jellyfish. The jellyfish feels the current. It's not seen. There's no visual other than the movement of the jellyfish. So me moving is being affected, right, John?
Right.
And yeah, so it's this dual, we got to learn to work in a dual capacity, but sometimes we have to hone one side, but our education system, and you've pointed this out, and I totally agree, only emphasizes the conceptual and doesn't help our children learn to do the nonverbals, empathy. I've been lately just flaming because of Kavanaugh going, look at, there can be empathy without your brains falling out. You know, come on, get real. But a lot of people I've talked to, they're one or the other. You know, I'm sorry I'm going off, but this whole Kavanaugh thing just affected me because of feeling the dissidence in our nation around the people taking power and being put in positions of power. It knocked my ass off.
Well, what I like about Karen Barad and many of the thinkers that we're exploring with Gebzer as well, and Murphy and Watts and Castaneda, there was a political dimension to their work.
And I think so.
That is part of our lineage here.
Yeah.
I think we have to use all these models and use them well, use all of our knowledge, our body knowledge, our
exactly.
modeling.
Exactly. Tools.
And take it into these forums as we've been doing on Cosmos. I believe that this is a great community service we're doing, and we're benefiting from it directly. So it's not just volunteer work we're doing. We're getting huge benefits, I think.
Yeah, because some of the semantic work, John, that book, Diverse Bodies and Diverse Practices, one of the ideas is, how you move your body or relate to your body affects how you think.
Right.
So I have personal experience coming out of trauma. If I didn't get up and move my body. And I just said, you know, I noticed that there was a link of me being more depressed.
Right.
So a lot of times before I even clearly think something, I start moving my body to help my thinking get clearer, if that makes sense.
Right. And you noticed, as you were asking me clean questions, that I started making movements.
Yes, exactly.
It's like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have words for this.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is a metaphor.
Exactly. No. And I'm just speaking for myself, in contrast to trying to work with other people. I realize that. Other people, that's strange. Why are you doing that?
Right.
No, I understand that that's a metaphor.
And it's a body language.
Yes, exactly.
Dancers and actors do. But it's something that when we go into most of our communication spaces, it's from the neck up.
Exactly.
The body is loud, you know. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. So any closing remarks, Doug or Michael? I know we're right at the 2-hour mark.
Let Doug go first and then I'll go last or whatever.
I'm really enjoying listening to this conversation, and like Johnny has stated, it came into this attempting to piece together a lot of recent thoughts, an ongoing process, and I felt our flowing conversation from the beginning is a demonstration of exactly what I would like to have happen at any given time. I got lost in there a few times, and the connection got distracted there too as well. But I like Karen Berard and her influence from Haraway, and including the political dimension into what we're working on here. I don't see the faces out on any screen as a role model, modeling how I need to live in the world. And it's the faces that surround me within my own world and so projecting my body into the world is literally creating, modeling these individual points, people, or things to become just the ideal space that you would like to inherit. That's where I'm coming from and where I've arrived at. I'm going to leave here to experience the world in at least a new way for the next few hours till the next something distracts me from what I hope to achieve.
And what I'm hoping for is maybe after we've had a couple of sessions like this, building on what we've done before previously and what we did today, we could get into a presentation mode. So we could, you know, pull our drawings and our representations. And I know, Doug, you're very adept at looking at these videos and making really good notes. Because I think it's that archival mindset that actually takes these performances that we've done and then adds another layer of complexity by reflecting upon those discourse events. And I enjoy that. I know you do. And Michael, I suspect you do this as well, because you
can look
at some videos. So I think this is a very rich opportunity for all of us to model, you know, our own participation and our own patterns of observing. And those may change as we participate together in these forums. And I hope we can bring these to other forums that are on Cosmos.
Awesome.
The cafe, just as was done recently with Heather and, you know, doing that rehearsal. You weren't there this Monday. I don't think you were there either, Doug. It was yesterday, but we did a little rehearsal for them.
Yeah.
And some comments on their performance that they're going to give.
They're going to post that though, right?
Yeah, they are. So I'm just saying how I thought that was a lovely kind of exchange that we had yesterday, and we could do that too.
Okay.
We could develop something that we could then present to the larger group for feedback and just to update them so that we can experiment, we can test drive,
right?
We can do a road test, and then we can say, hey, this is something that we're working on that might be of interest to the larger group.
Right.
And I believe that has a benefit for the larger group and for each of us. Because it gets This is what other groups are working on. Sometimes I'm not able to join in on those conversations, and or, you know, do I think I have anything to contribute to those conversations? But I will keep track of them as best I can on the Cosmos, just to see what those diffraction patterns are.
Yeah.
And I believe the more of us who are looking for, you know, who are paying attention. I'm in the Aurobindo group, and so is Doug, and we're all of us participants on the cafe, and mm-hmm. the three of us so far have been focusing our attention on altered states. Right. I think there's a great benefit of working small and then expanding to a larger group.
Exactly. That's my field. That's why I like this, because not that I'm not interested in a lot of the others. Some of it is just over my head, and I like watching it and maybe getting a feel for it. And a lot of the ideas cross over. It's just that this has really taken me a notch to understand. And Peters talks about this in the introduction, that, you know, we have a evolutionary history of feeling danger from other humans.
Right.
And right. That can happen online, or it can happen in person. And so with that said, this platform and what we're doing and how I participated has actually made it safe to hone my skills better, so that I can reverse and go back out and work with my body's noticing sensations of how other people are responding to me, or more importantly, how do I respond to other people,
right.
You know, that may be getting triggered or something. I just had just give you an example is I've been working with this kind of work with my son, because he's 32 and we've been walking, and I feel now we're finally at a point over 2 or 3 years that maybe we both can express our differences and maybe show animation and not get triggered, because he's passionate just like me, but some of his views, it rubs up against me, and I have to challenge his views sometimes. But we, because of trying to outgrow the father-son dynamic and move into an adult dynamic, that's a different shift. This kind of stuff has helped me model for him what I want him and I to move toward.
Cool. That's very cool.
And both things, I can, it's just something about doing it here, because there's been a couple times that, because it's online, I have a better sense of safety so that I can watch that some people say things that do trigger me, and I keep my mouth shut, or I just acknowledge, you know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, yeah. I've had to modulate the affective zones in my own behavior before I can address anyone else's. You know.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's a good thing in the sense it hones my delivery system. You know, and then when I'm offline, then I go yell and scream.
Let's face it, on this technology, which is really not designed to go to this kind of depth.
Okay.
It's really superficial, and go out and buy something. That's what this is what technology is for, basically.
Yes.
I think we're using it in a very surreptitious way.
Yes.
And this is the blessing, I think.
Yes.
Using technology for
That's exactly what I'm trying to articulate. And so that's why I thank both of you for setting this up and being able to participate. And even the other ones that I've attended, don't get me wrong, they've all been great, but it's really honed my skills to help me better work with the face-to-face, because, you know, the complaint is that I understand that this technology can get people away from face-to-face, and that has a component, but at the same time, some of the things that popped up is, no, it's not safe, because people just tear you a new one, and you get people, teenagers committing, because of cyberbullying. So no matter, to me, I don't know if I'm saying this right, whether you're face-to-face or using this technology, there's a danger you have to pay attention to.
There's always a shadow to be dealt
with. Okay, okay.
We're working with our shadows here. But I know we're almost up.
Okay.
I just wanted to suggest that we could continue to maybe look at that list. Okay. I'll be reading his book. I don't know if any of you guys have this book, but it's a gold mine.
I got to go through my books. I think I did get it. I got to get it. I think
do you have this, Douglas? Do you know this work by Michael Murray?
I have not read it, but I do have it.
Yeah, it's a good. I think it, just like you guys, when you're in your when you're reading, as you were doing today, as we were all doing, you know, you find a word or a phrase or an idea that an author presents, bring that with you. That could be the Cohen, you know, because there may be something in there that you could model. Just taking a phrase from Michael Murphy's list and just doing a few clean language questions and start to generate all kinds of explorations. So we could do it in the next session if you like.
Are we going to meet in a week or another 2 weeks? How's that going to work?
The final Octavia Butler session will be a week from now.
Oh, okay.
So we'll do 2 weeks. Like always, if we can collaborate enough, we can figure out if maybe a Thursday or evening I mentioned could be possible. So I do like the momentum of having it weekly. We could talk about it.
This will work in 2 weeks and we can take it from there the same time, unless something comes up, of course.
Yeah.
And in the future, if you want to switch to an evening, Douglas, I'm very flexible.
And I am too, because I'm three hours behind you guys. So whatever is comfortable in the evening for you guys, you know, I know you guys you're in a different time zone, but you set the time. And I mean, I'll make it work. That's just the bottom line.
Okay. So we're up. So in 2 weeks, same time, same place. And hopefully, and I'll get a chance to review this video when it comes out. And I'm sure more ideas will come flowing through, so we can always.
Yeah, this has been really great, Doug and Johnny. It's been really great.
My pleasure.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, totally, totally. You guys have a good 2 weeks. Talk to you later.
You.
Yeah.
Goodbye. Take care.
See you on the astral.
Yeah.